Hello, all things Trek listeners. We couldn't be here to record a show today on account of going down to Portland to see Star Trek in the Park. Woo! So instead, you get to listen to an interview I recorded with Ken and John of the Mission Log podcast while I was at Star Trek Las Vegas. You'll notice the crowd sounds in the background. Just think of it as ambiance. I'm sorry there wasn't anything I could do about it. Enjoy the episode. And welcome, everyone, to another episode of All Things Trek, part two of my discussion with John Champion and Ken Ray with the Mission Log podcast. Unfortunately, part one will be lost to the ages forever, but we will continue soldiering on with part two. So welcome back, you guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's like part one never even happened.
Exactly. I don't even remember part one.
Now, if only we could say that about a certain episode one that is from a different franchise entirely.
Nice.
All right. Yeah. So when we left off last time, we were talking about what happens to certain planets when Kirk shows up, upsets the social order or the governmental order or what have you, and then leaves. And we were wondering, you know, what goes on those planets. And the last one we didn't get a chance to talk about, so we're going to talk about it now, was Omega Glory, which is a little different because we can't really blame Kirk for this one. This was not, you know, really Kirk's doing that caused all of these changes, but it was a Starfleet captain, so as far as I'm concerned, close enough.
Yeah, Captain Tracy, who has a strong disregard for the Prime Directive.
To say the least.
Yeah. And it just kind of cracks me up at the end when Spock asks Kirk, well, you know, well, what about the Prime Directive here? Kirk's like, don't worry about it.
I don't feel like Kirk violated the Prime Directive there, though. All he did was remind people of what they had already said themselves.
Yeah, I mean, the stage had already been set, that it was this huge upset. Yes, Captain Tracy is responsible for all of that.
Right.
But Kirk, Spock, McCoy, everybody were deeply embedded in what was going on there.
Yeah.
You know, okay.
After the fact.
And there's something to be said for Kirk, you know, at least somewhat trying to put things right, because Tracy has messed up this whole... okay, I think we may have had an audio error there, but I think I can hear you guys okay.
I'm not getting it now, so...
Okay. Yeah, okay, now that I say that, it seems to have evened out.
Okay.
Groovy.
Cool.
Okay.
Where were we?
Show recording.
I believe we were talking about how Kirk had... Yeah, Kirk... So Tracy has messed up this whole situation, and Kirk is at least to a certain extent trying to put it right by trying to be like, no, you guys have this this constitution which is similar to but legally distinct from the United States of America's constitution. And they have that flag, which, I mean, as you guys have pointed out, is a little bit, really, that flag? Did it have to be that flag?
It's just totally coincidental.
Totally coincidental.
Yeah.
And I got to admit, Ken, when you gave your impassioned defense at the end of that episode, I have always written that episode off as just being another really cheesy TOS bad idea, but... Your defense of it, I'm not quite ready to go there with you, but I liked it a lot, and it made me see it in a different light.
There are two episodes. I think what I compared it to was the Mr. T cartoon.
Yep.
in our episode, where, you know, at the end of it, they would always do some sort of, you know, drugs are bad, or eat your vegetables, or, you know, brush your teeth, or whatever. I mean, that's pretty much it. You've got sort of a neat, interesting story. Maybe racist, maybe nationalist, but you've got sort of a neat, interesting story up to the fourth act. And in the fourth act, it really is just a civics lesson.
Yep.
It really is just a don't be a jerk. It really is, hey, America, remember what you said you wanted America to be? Let's be that. I mean, the episode itself is a mess. The episode itself is just, but personally, I feel like the messages in it sort of override that or overpower that. If you're willing to watch it, I mean, that's the one thing. We, because of the show that we do, there are episodes we both agree are painful. Mm-hmm. I personally think Omega Glory is a painful episode.
Yeah.
But what we are sitting down to do is trying to figure out, okay, what were they saying? What were they trying to say? What messages or morals can we take out of it?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're watching it with that eye, which most people aren't. I mean, most people are watching Star Trek, and they might get something about it, but they're not, like, actively like, oh, come on, there's got to be something here. Because, I mean, you know... We got 45 minutes. They're not going to fill themselves, right?
So,
I mean, we've got to find something. And then, I mean, if you're able to watch it that way, you're going to find a lot more stuff. I mean, just because, you know, you're actually looking specifically for that stuff. And then knowing that I'm watching it for that, I really do feel like that is one of the best. It's that and the Corporal Might Maneuver. I feel like that's one of the best Kirk speeches because... I mean, he's basically holding everybody who's watching him, everybody in the country at the time, he's holding them all to a standard that we're still having problem with today.
Yeah, no kidding. Something about snow days,
that whole thing.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But there's definitely a powerful message there. To me, it always felt a little bit USA, kind of. It almost felt like we were championing how much better we were than communists.
Except for the part where he said these words have to apply to the Combs just as much as the Yangs,
yeah.
Or they don't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
I totally get it, and I really liked that plea that you made. It was very interesting to listen to. So, but with the messages aside, what do we think is going to happen to that planet? Like, is Kirk's speech going to be enough to overcome this, several thousand years of animosity that the Yangs and the Combs have for each other?
Well, that's the thing. We don't know enough about the planet. We don't know how big it is, what the other cultures are on that planet. I mean, the problem is you kind of assume a lot in Star Trek that there is one culture per planet, and they all kind of do the same thing. And you know, on this planet, you've got two cultures, and that sort of represents the entire planet. And now we've said, the U.S. Constitution is the best way to take care of the entire planet's difficulties and the entire planet's problems. So I don't know. I mean, I would like to think, as they like to leave you with so many episodes of Star Trek, I would like to think that everything works out better because Kirk gave the speech and then everybody's happy. But the problem is, and we were discussing this in the Lost episode, is that you can't account for the individual motivations that might upset that idea. You know, the Yangs are powerful, and the Yangs may be motivated for that constitution to not be the law of the land. So they can leave and come back minutes or hours or years later, and that entire thing be upside down from the way they left it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, the Kirk speech is, you know, it's best a minute after the Kirk speech. An hour after the Kirk speech, it's also still pretty good. A week after the Kirk speech, I mean, both that speech and Corbin Might Maneuver are the whole thing of don't just do the easy thing. But that is an easy thing for Kirk to say because he's got 430-something people and a starship. You know what I mean? Claude Williams says, I don't really get what you're saying, but I'm going to try. Okay, well, he's 5 to 7 days from going, I don't really get what he's saying, and I don't know that I'm getting anything from trying anymore.
He didn't understand the words anyway. You know.
He
plagued the village.
Yes. So
he was having trouble.
So I mean, if you're actually asking what their chances are, slim. I mean, that's what I think. Yeah. I mean, their chances are slim because now they have come out of the barbarian wilderness into the city, and so they've got all these structures they didn't have before, and probably there's lots of food they didn't have before, and lots of spoils they didn't have before, and it's going to be much easier to just go ahead and take those by force than it will be to say so. We've kind of got you cornered, but we're going to let you live, and we're all going to work together, and this is going to be great. That seems unlikely. Although, like John says, you want to think that that's exactly what's going
to
happen.
We'd like to think.
Yeah, the good news is, I mean, it'll be, well, we're never coming to this planet again.
So. See, I think that's part of what bothers me about that episode, is that it's sort of saying, well, the strength of this document, this one American document, is so strong.
It was a message to Americans. Message to Americans.
Yeah,
it is at a time when people, I mean, okay, so
and therein lies the disappointment for the episode.
Why?
It's a message to Americans. It's not, Star Trek is bigger than that. Star Trek is bigger than the jingoistic message than
it's
just
not jingoistic.
Go America.
It's not that. It's not that. Because of the whole thing, he is doing the whole thing. Sorry. He's doing the whole thing where you can just march behind the flag. You can do that.
Yep.
He is not saying that. If it were just a jingoistic thing, then when they marched in with that flag, he'd be like, oh, look, okay, well, it's the good guys, and they're more powerful, and they're going to take over the city, and so that's fine. He gives them the civic lesson. And in giving them the civic lesson, he's giving everybody who's watching the civics lesson. I mean, that really is it. It's not about jingoism. Because that would have been an easy thing to do. It would have been easy to just, you know, then start chanting USA, USA, and then get behind the Yangs and go ahead and kill the Combs, and we're done. They start to roll in, and he says, hey, ho, 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 you're better than this. Mm-hmm. You say you're better than this. You're not even reading what you're saying gives you the right to do this, so let me read it to you. You don't actually have the right to do the things that you're trying to do now. And we know you don't have the right to do that because you said right here, you don't have the right to do that. I mean, so it doesn't feel like a jingoistic thing to me.
I still think there's an amendment in that constitution somewhere about stripping away the rights of Combs. I think they didn't read far enough.
There might be. Did that amendment get as far as internment camps? Is that the question we're asking?
Right.
And there is something to be said, I think, for even though Star Trek has become bigger than America at the time, it certainly wasn't. And there is something to be said for that it was being broadcast.
He says in the speech that it's bigger than this.
Right, exactly. But my point is that the reason he was using the American Constitution is because it was primarily for an American audience, so we had to use something they'd recognize.
Well, and he's an American.
Sure. Right.
I had somebody yesterday ask me, I mean, everybody starts from where they start. That's the thing. I understand what you're saying about you kind of wish it didn't do that because it, you know, shrinks it down. But it was 1968. We barely had, how many people in America in 1968 would have even heard of Doctor Who? They would have to have been people who lived in the UK and came over here.
Sure.
We did not have anything like the, you know, the global access to information, Gangnam style. Are you kidding me? Nothing like that would have even occurred. Everybody starts from where they start. We had a guy here at the table yesterday who's like, so you guys talk about, you know, a particular actress coming on, the actress of the week being very pretty, you know, all this stuff. And I was like, yes. He's like, when is the last time you commented on how attractive a male guest star of the week was? And I was like, I get where you're going. And here's the thing. John and I are heterosexual males. We start from where we start. I mean, I can tell the guy's attractive, but it's not the kind of thing. It's not what I grew up, you know. And he was like, well, as a non-heterosexual male, I do notice it. And I'm like, yeah, probably not going to change a lot, though, because John and I are still, I mean, we're still where we start from. It's the same thing with the American, it's the same thing with the American story. There are a bunch of Americans sitting in America writing a story, but I do believe in the story that they wrote, they tried to reach past that. With just that line, these words have to apply to them as much as you, or they're worthless.
Yeah. And it was a nice message in a, I think we can agree, a flawed story.
It was a flawed telling.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So in a step sideways, I didn't have this in my notes, it just occurred to me. What about in a private little war? Because I'm not certain what the end is of... Oh, sorry. I'm not talking about a private little war in a bit of a step sideways, because I'm not certain what the ending message is when Kirk, you know, Kirk says we're going to replicate them some muskets, and then he starts talking about serpents.
Because
I'm wondering, is he basically saying, okay, we're going to have an escalating arms race forever on this planet, or are they going to try to prove that the Klingons are messing around with this treaty and try to deal with it that way? Because that was their original plan, and they just seem to have abandoned it about two-thirds of the way into the episode.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the fear that Kirk has, and rightfully so. Certainly the fear that McCoy has is that they are stepping into an escalating arms race, and they will keep providing weapons until there are no more weapons to provide or nobody left on that planet. But I think, as Ken really beautifully pointed out in our discussion on that episode, it's not necessarily about finding the solution. It's the expression of the frustration that we had at that time.
Right.
And legitimately can still have with escalating wars around the world, but made so much more acute by what was happening in Vietnam.
Yeah.
There really is no good answer to that. And Star Trek, for a show that provides a lot of good answers, also provides a lot of good questions.
Totally.
Yeah.
You know,
a lot
harder questions.
Yeah. That episode to me, I mean, again, not to keep saying civics lesson, but that episode was current events.
Yeah, it was.
And it was just brutal and tragic. I mean, it was such a horrible thing to get to the end of that episode and have Kirk say, the only thing that makes sense right now is to keep these people just strong enough to keep fighting each other. We can't give somebody enough arms to totally wipe out the other. Nor can we just sit there and let everybody rule over them.
Yeah.
And the problem is that's where That's where we were in 1967 in Vietnam, right?
And I think the likelihood of it escalating tensions between the Federation and the Klingons are a sure thing. That's the unfortunate part of it, is that we're building our own war by doing that. And it's, you know, the title alone, calling it a private little war. Well, it is no such thing. It is a public war that will be made more public and made more dangerous and more problematic on a much, much larger scale.
Well, you say that. You say that, and yet if you can have it be a proxy war, then there's nothing to stop the Federation and the Klingons from still negotiating, because you don't have a Klingon ship facing off with a Federation ship. You've got one faction on this one planet, and where are they getting those weapons? Oh, who knows? And this other faction on this other planet, oh, well, where are they getting these weapons? Who knows? I mean, it really is sort of a... that was a horribly, horribly depressing episode. it was just a tragically, horribly depressing episode.
And then that was one of the places, because, in TNG, to step out of the timeline for a minute, like you guys never do, in TNG, the Klingons and the Federation are allies, and almost more than any other episode in TOS, I want to know how they resolved that.
Yeah.
Like, is that still happening? Like, is that the one place that the Klingons and the Federation are still fighting? Have they worked their way up to phasers now, and the hill people and the village people, as it were, are like, just blowing each other up with energy weapons? I want to know, and of course, Star Trek is never going to tell me.
Well, the Klingons and the Federation aren't fighting there, though.
Right, there you go.
That's it. I mean, they're not. I mean, maybe it is, like, a horrible planet where it's just devolved to fighting forever at that point, but the Klingons and the Federation's hands are clean. Federation probably never even knows that Kirk gave them muskets, right? Is he going to tell them?
Well, he would have to, unless he's going to come back to give them rifles when the Klingons give them rifles, because the Klingons are going to keep doing this, right? Like, there's no reason for them to stop.
Well, we had a debate, actually, about whether or not the Klingons were giving them weapons or teaching them to make weapons. That was one of my favorite lines of John's, give a man a gun, he'll kill for a day. Teach a man to make a gun, he'll kill for a lifetime.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's what I felt like they were doing. So it's possible they were just setting the ball rolling, but...
I got the feeling it was a combination of both, right? Because they were talking about making upgrades to this smith, like this local smithy.
Yeah.
But it was still pretty clear to me that they were bringing in big cases of these weapons, from a Klingon ship.
Our listeners wrote back, some of them very strongly said, the Klingons are giving them weapons. And some wrote back very strongly saying, the Klingons are teaching them how to make weapons.
Yeah.
There's still a little wiggle room there, however you look at it. I mean, the thing that's difficult here is that this is the Klingon method of empire expansion.
Yeah.
So the negotiation in order to achieve that peace between the Federation and the Klingons, it isn't just about, we'll stop fighting you and you stop fighting us. It's telling the Klingons, you have to stop what you're doing as Klingons, which is expanding your empire.
Right.
Or maybe that's just a lost cause. Maybe it's just like, well, okay, you were there first. You were there with the weapons first. So now this planet is yours to add to your empire. You know, who knows?
Yeah.
I think a novelization. I think one of the brilliant writers who handles the expanded Star Trek universe.
Mm-hmm.
If they haven't already, they probably should tackle that.
What's really interesting to me, though, about the Klingons, I mean, we see the Klingons change quite a bit from the original series to... When did they become so honorable? Because they're not honorable.
Yeah. No, it's next gen. I mean, you get into the movies.
Yeah.
And...
There's a certain amount of honor with... what was Christopher Lloyd's character?
Crew.
Yeah. I mean, he's a bastard.
He's
the enemy, no question. But, I mean, he's not cheating. He's fighting.
Yeah.
But he's not cheating. I mean, you go back to Trouble with Tribbles. I mean, they're horrible people. And what was the one with...
About the Organians, about John Colicos
I don't remember what that episode is called.
He lies. So he lies in that episode.
Yeah, he does.
I mean, that's my point. I mean, there's outright lying. I mean, they're more Ferengi than they are what we think of as Klingon.
That's true. They hadn't become like space Vikings yet.
Yeah.
And you can kind of trace that, how you can go through the movies and how they like go from just being the bad guys, they slowly get more honor. And then they get into Star Trek VI, they don't really say honor, but they still have that kind of mentality, which is running concurrently with TNG.
Yeah.
Which is, and who knows, like, if
that's actually supposed to have been a cultural shift in the Klingons, or if we're just, you know, supposed to ignore that they were different before.
I think it feels to me more like it's that. I mean, they were always the big bad guys, but there's not really enough there. I mean,
well, but you say, I mean, now we get into sort of the reality of production.
Yeah.
And that's that every time Star Trek introduces a character or a species represented by a character, you're given one or two messages in shorthand to define who and what that is.
Yeah.
And the Klingons were introduced once. These were the bad guys, they're manipulative. And then after the audience reaction was such that it's decided to bring them back, because remember, in the original series, he didn't bring anything back.
Nah.
You know? Then suddenly you had to flesh them out a little bit. Same thing happened with the Ferengi. Same thing happens with the Vulcans. You know, we have Spock, and we're presented with the unemotional Vulcan, and then you add a little layer to him. I love, love, love his moment in The Naked Time, where he's having his breakdown.
Yeah.
So you reveal this idea about his emotional core, but then you start to reveal more about other Vulcans by doing that. You know, that other Vulcans are also having to keep their emotions in check.
Yeah.
Other Vulcans are maybe having trouble assimilating with the humans that they work with or the Federation at large. You know, there's all this stuff that you have to add to it. So by the time you get to the Klingons and you decide this is a fan-favorite character, fan-favorite species that we need to bring back, you don't have a character if you're writing one word.
Yeah.
You have a character for an episode if you're writing John Colicos, you know, or writing for John Colicos. But you can't make an entire species based on the traits of one actor in one role.
Yeah.
So it's a tricky line to toe. You could say the same thing about the Borg. You know, the Borg were arguably scarier when we knew nothing about them. But then by the time you introduce a hierarchy, you have a queen, and you have all these different motivations there.
Thanks, Ken.
Then that, you know, that changes what they are.
Yeah.
For better or for worse. You know, I think it'd be argued both ways there. But, this is sort of my rant about how the reality of production then has to bend in some ways to fit the audience desire.
And, I mean, to a certain extent, the changing of the species is going to be inevitable as you're trying to make them more interesting than just the bad guys, right?
Yeah.
And, like, I mean, and you know, I had no problem with the Klingons having ridges. I didn't think that had to be explained. Enterprise explained it, and they did okay, but it wasn't, I didn't think it was necessary. But all right, so moving on to the next subject I wanted to ask you guys about. I wanted to talk a little bit about robotics in Star Trek.
Because fortunately, you're seated here with a robot.
Well, you know, and we have a certain
Sorry.
A certain doctor.
My humor circuits are slow today. I apologize.
We have a certain Dr. Corby who couldn't be here today to talk to us.
He
about
was here
this.
Yesterday.
He was here yesterday.
Oh, was he?
Did you see him?
Yeah.
No, I'm afraid I didn't.
Oh, I cannot wait until you see him today.
Yeah.
He's not Corby today.
Okay.
I'm so excited.
Shout out to our listener, Jeff.
But so even beyond Corby, and in fact, Corby may not actually have had this problem, but I noticed in TOS over and over again, they kind of have this idea that if you're a robot, you can't feel anything. Even if you are a humanoid consciousness or brain put in a robot body, you no longer have feelings. Where do you think that idea came from?
Probably the fear of dehumanization that was going on, the fear of automation in the 1960s, I would guess. The whole, we haven't gotten it. Well, yeah, the ultimate computer just hit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of, technology is wonderful, but I mean, there was certainly a certain amount of fear of it as well. And you want to really sell the message that man is not going to be usurped or replaced by technology. That would be my guess. And there's also, I mean, there's not as much. We've gone further in the past 40 years in technology. It's easier now to think about a machine that, whether it thinks or not, it can fool you into thinking it thinks. Or whether it feels or not, it can be programmed, or it can sort of present traits of feeling. Not yet, but we're much closer to that now. We sort of see that possibility more clearly. Yeah. I mean, robots in the 1960s were practically the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz.
Right.
And they could move, they could do other, but they don't have a heart. And maybe that's supposed to make people walking around right now feel better. It's like, don't worry about it. Even if it advances, it's never going to be you.
You wouldn't want that.
Want what?
I would say that's the message of the audience.
Yeah. You wouldn't want that. The thing that I find most mind-blowing, honestly, about robots is the or the emotions that robots feel is the idea that we inherently feel something because we inherently feel something. Mm-hmm. We're taught. We just don't know it. We don't realize. It all happens like when we're so young. It all starts. It's all input from the second, well, from before the time that you draw your first breath, right? And so we think, well, they're programmed, so it's not as important. Well, so are you. Mm-hmm. You just weren't programmed by one guy who had control over the whole thing.
Unless you had a very bad family.
Unless, what do you mean? As far as being programmed?
Because your parents are definitely a big part of programming, you know, you as a child and the people you hang out with.
But they're only part of a program.
Right, exactly.
That's the thing, but we don't look at it that way. We think, well, because we're human, I know this stuff because I'm human. You know this stuff because of all of the sensory input, because of all of the ones and zeros that were turned on and off by everything that's happened in your life so far. And so the idea that robots are going to be inferior because, well, they're just programmed. We're just programmed. It's just on a completely different, much more complex level. And yet, so willy-nilly, it's insane.
There's a great example of that in a book called The Anthropologist on Mars, which is I don't remember the name of the author, but that's the title of the book. And one of the subjects that he worked with was a man who was blind since he was like four, since he was very young, and he was in his 50s at the time. And a new surgery had come out that would be able to correct the flaws with his eyes and allow him to see again. And so they went through the surgery, and he basically couldn't see. All the information he was getting from his eyes was completely useless to him because he had never learned, or it had been so long since he had learned how to recognize a human face or a cup or anything simple, that when they expected him to, he had a very hard time because they expected him to just be able to go back into life and just be a sighted person, and he just couldn't do it. So that was a very good example of how we are in fact programmed to a certain degree. Now, of course, the real question we have to ask ourselves about robots in Star Trek is, if Kirk met Data, would he try to explode him? This is an important question that I think we all want to know the answer to.
Data the whole time, he's like, no, I'm good, I'm a nice robot. Kirk's like, I don't trust it. I mean...
He might try.
Well, here's the thing. I think Kirk would have, he would have a really big problem with Dr. Soong.
Yeah, so that's true.
You know, that would be the difficulty. He might be able to accept Data, and Data is programmed. This will sound wrong. I don't mean it. Data is programmed to please. You know, Data is programmed.
Well, he is fully functional.
Well, he is. But he's programmed to assimilate. He's programmed to do duties that we ask him to do.
Right.
Is he programmed to do that, or is that what he's chosen to do?
I think it's a little bit of both.
Right.
But I think that's part of the inherent programming.
His programming allows him to make that choice.
Which is
sort of the same way it is with us, right? I mean, we have all this genetic programming that is so complicated it allows us to make these choices.
Right.
Mm-hmm. As the most oversimplified way of talking about the human consciousness ever, maybe.
Well, no, but I mean, when you say he's programmed to do that, it's not like he's Richie Rich's Iona or anything like that. I mean, built to be a butler. He was not built to be...
Yeah, but he is programmed. You know, you have to compare Data to Lore. Okay, Lore is sort of, his programming makes him a free agent with sort of these motivations that benefit himself.
Right.
Whereas Data is programmed to kind of be subservient.
I'm not sure I agree. I think it's just a difference of what pleases yourself. There's a fascinating conversation that I had with a friend of mine several years ago about whether or not Mother Teresa was altruistic.
Oh, dear.
And the answer is, well, I guess, but she is still served by doing that. Mm-hmm. Data, I mean, you say he's programmed to serve, but I don't think so. There is something in Data's makeup, whatever it is, that makes serving in Starfleet what pleases him. I mean, that's the whole self-actualization thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's actually the best as far as being able to be a self-actualized character because he doesn't have to worry about eating. Mm-hmm. He barely has to worry about energy. I mean, there's almost nothing that he has to worry about. All of his needs are taken care of. And so he's then able to pursue what he wants to do. For whatever reason, what he wants to do is be in Starfleet. Okay. Right. I mean, he ends up taking the Lucchese chair. Is that it? At Cambridge?
Yeah.
Wasn't that Isaac Newton's position?
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, so at some point, he decides it's not about serving anymore. He's going to go off and do something else. Mm-hmm. I mean, assuming that all good things is actually... canon.
Right.
Kind of canon.
Which I guess it's not, because it's all timeline, whatever.
Sure.
But,
Can't blame Nero for that one.
No, you can't. In fact, if he never takes a Lucchese chair, you might be able to blame Nero for that.
Oh, okay.
Oh, does it even happen? Oh, my goodness.
No.
Oh.
Does the Enterprise ever get a third nacelle? These are hard-hitting questions.
Warp 25, was it?
Warp 13.
13.
Which
is what?
My vote is no.
Huh?
My vote is no.
No on the third nacelle?
No.
Gives him something to cut off. Originally, they said, let's do 5 for the last episode. No. 5 is nuts.
No, this is crazy.
I'll give you 3. Yeah. Okay, 3, and then we're out.
I kind of like that phaser lance, though, I got to say. Just the fanboy in me kind of likes it. But one thing interesting about Data, since we're talking about Data now, that he does, and I have to wonder if this is some kind of fail-safe programming. He seems to have a very difficult time with the concept of not doing what he's told by someone who is higher rank than him. Do you guys remember the episode The Offspring? In case for anyone who doesn't, it's an episode where Data constructs a child.
Right.
He constructs another android.
Lol.
But he is going through, he's gone through all this work. He clearly, it's maybe not right to say that he loves his daughter because he himself says he can't feel that emotion, but he is clearly invested in his daughter that he's created. And at one point, the admiral, one of Starfleet's long line of evil admirals, hears this plea of his, hears all this evidence about why Lol should stay with Data, and says, nope, send Lol over to me. I'm going to take her back to my starbase. And he's like, okay. And he's totally going to do it. Mm-hmm. And Picard has to step in and say, Data, don't do that. And I have to wonder if there is some kind of programming within Data that just makes him defer to authority in that fashion. Because if the admiral had tried to do that to Lore, his head would be on the other side of the room. I mean,
yeah, but he's a good Starfleet officer, and Starfleet's a quasi-militaristic, thing. I mean, Spock. Mm-hmm. When we talk about the original series, Spock won't make a move without somebody okaying it.
That's true.
He really will not. Somebody who's higher than him. I can't remember which episode it was, but basically,
was it
Doomsday Machine?
Yeah, it was
Doomsday Machine. Mm-hmm. Spock's going to let him just run the Enterprise straight into the side of the Doomsday Machine if that's what he wants to do.
Yep.
And it takes Kirk, who doesn't actually have the authority at that point, to say do something else. Mm-hmm. But it takes Kirk telling Spock. Then Spock has the strength to do it.
Yeah.
So I mean that might. And I'm not saying that makes Spock a weak character. I'm not saying that makes Data a weak character. I'm saying that makes them lower on the food chain than would a captain or an admiral or a commodore even than any of those characters would be.
Star Trek and their commodores.
I know.
What not a good track record.
That? Yeah. You know what commodore is? Commodore is promoting somebody up because you just don't want them to be any place that they can actually screw things up anymore. Like, they accidentally got to be captain of a starship, then they did almost run it into the side of something. And they're like, oh, okay, that's not going to work, but we have so much invested in this guy that why don't you go be a commodore?
Yeah.
That'll be great. We'll drop you off here. Another ship will come by. Mm-hmm. Screw up what they're doing for a week. They'll drop you off someplace.
I mean, there's a reason we never saw any commodores in TNG.
Yeah, right.
I don't think so. Pretty sure.
Oh, wait a minute. What about the what's the episode at the end of season one with the creatures living inside?
Was he a commodore?
Yeah,
I thought he was like a lieutenant or something. The guy who had the mother who had the queen in it, right?
Yeah.
I don't think he was even a flag rank. I'm pretty sure he was like a commander.
Okay. So for some reason I was thinking it was like a lot of surely there was a commodore in there somewhere. I don't know.
There were a lot of different ranks, that's for sure.
Maybe they just keep sending the commodores further and further out.
They're just manning those border stations?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, you got commodores who think it's a great idea to take a shortcut through Romulan territory. What could possibly go wrong?
They're on the B-arc.
Yes,
they are.
All right, so in addition to robotics, another element of transhumanism that was in the original series was genetic engineering in the form of Khan!
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, my apologies,
good
but
job.
I just blew out
good
a
job.
Microphone. But so you have the characters in Space Seed, and you have this whole idea of the eugenics wars, which I don't know if you guys remember, they happened around 1996.
It was a rough time. Yeah, I remember that.
Okay, so what is up with this message that we see that if you try to increase the abilities of humanity, it is always going to end up badly? What's going on here?
Just ask the people from the planet of Miri.
Oh dear, it's Miri.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Life prolongation will get you every time.
Yeah, don't mess with Mother Nature. That's interesting. I don't know why that would be a common thread. Star Trek, a show that kind of celebrates using technology when it can benefit us, when it can be used wisely.
Mm-hmm.
So why picking on that one particular thing to say this is something that not only can we not use it wisely, we should just not do it at all.
Yeah.
And in fact, we revisit that in Deep Space Nine with Dr. Bashir.
Sir Julian Bashir.
Yeah. So it's interesting that that would be a continued thread. Now, it was very prescient that it would foreshadow. You know, when Space Seed came out, then fast forward 30 years later, 40 years later, that we are making huge strides in our ability to understand the human genome. What the genome was... The first human genome was finished in 94, 96?
90, I want to say 96 or 97.
Something like that.
I remember. But, it was supposed to be like 99 or 2000. They finished early, I know that.
Okay.
I think they just wanted to go outside and play, though, so I'm not sure they actually finished. They might have just told us they did.
Yeah, okay.
They were tired, okay?
But yeah, but that's, 30 years after Space Seed, and we're getting there. You know, we're cracking that. And it did open up this very often sort of shrill and misunderstood knee-jerk reaction to the idea. You know, as soon as we say that we can do this, then the immediate opposing reaction is, well, this is wrong. We need to start making laws.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think that's unfortunate. To me, science is a neutral proposition.
Mm-hmm.
Science is about a thing, a discovery, a piece of evidence that helps us to understand. It can be put into action positively or negatively. And then politicians who don't have an understanding of science step in and decide to start legislating science.
Don't they always?
Don't they always, yes.
Now, have you guys... I'm sorry.
Well, really quickly, it's also possible, though, that, put it in its context. I don't know that they were necessarily saying this is always going to be evil forever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we're assuming that there's some sort of UC Timmy moment to it, I mean, it may be about not taking shortcuts. It may also be about wanting to keep an eye on what you're doing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, because it would be very easy to take that and not say that it's about genetic engineering, but say, it would be very easy to write that just a tiny bit further and say, well, all technology is bad. Okay, well, we know that they're not saying all technology is bad because technology has advanced to a certain point. It's more about, it seems to me it's possible, it's more about being careful.
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe taking it slowly, not just, because they don't kill Khan.
Yeah.
Which would certainly be a possibility. Now, I mean, another reason, though, again, putting it in its context, we're only 22 years out of World War II, which had a lot to do with somebody going, oh, you know what sucks? Anybody who's not blonde-haired and blue-eyed. So tell you what we're going to do. We're going to kill those guys, and we're going to make sure that these guys can't reproduce, and we're going to try to grow these numbers. There's certainly that possibility as well. It may seem antithetical at that point. It may be an absolutely horrible idea. We might think, well, nobody's ever going to round anybody up and kill them again because of what they are, but there are other ways that it's, I don't know. It seems like contextually it might not just be about genetic engineering as bad, period.
Yeah. Well, but there is this idea that we see in Star Trek, a lot in the original series, about not having the responsibility for more power. Every time the Enterprise comes across an energy being that has evolved past their humanoid forms or their need for air and water and food, they send the Enterprise on their way. Like, you're not ready for this.
Right.
You can't handle this technology.
You run along home.
Yeah, yeah. And we do that to other cultures, But then you kind of open yourself up to this argument to say, well, what is the correct pace? What is the right pace for doing that? Because the advance of technology on Earth right now in the early 21st century, we grow our technology exponentially faster each and every year. So I don't know that there is a correct answer to that. The technology will always outpace our ability to popularly understand it or put it to its best use. So, maybe you could make a very general statement about that. Then, okay, well, be careful with your technology. Don't grow supermen who are bent on taking over the planet.
Yeah.
Whatever you do, don't create Miri, because we don't want to be annoyed.
Don't do that. Right. Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah. Whatever the, as far as I'm concerned, whatever the technology rate of advancement should be is whatever gets me my hoverboard fastest.
Yeah, no kidding, man. Yeah, 2015 is right around the corner.
I'm not seeing any hoverboards.
Yeah.
So one more thing on this topic. Have you guys seen the movie Gattaca?
Yes.
Okay.
I haven't seen it in forever.
Okay. Well, to recap, Gattaca's message or cautionary tale about the idea of genetic engineering is that it will create sort of an underclass of the people who either weren't wealthy enough or weren't born at the right time to get that engineering and therefore aren't as capable. And, of course, the movie is about one of those people who it turns out is capable of, you know, whatever he feels like. But Star Trek's message seems to be a little different in that they even say at one point in Deep Space Nine, I don't think they came out and said this in TOS, but in Deep Space Nine they say superior ability breeds superior ambition, which is an interesting difference there. They're not really so much worried about people who aren't engineered being able to compete. They're worried that giving these, it's almost a form of power corrupts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you guys think that that's, do you think that's an accurate way of describing the Star Trek's mindset on genetic engineering?
You know, we've seen a couple of times that idea of exploring absolute power corrupting. Mm-hmm. We see that a few times in the original series, and I brought it up once before in an episode of Mission Log that it's an interesting idea, and I guess it's sort of a cautionary tale. It's sort of like you have to keep an eye on those who have too much power. You have to have the checks and balances in place to make sure that power is not abused. But it is interesting that I brought it up in Mission Log that there's more recent studies to say that that may not necessarily be the case.
Yeah.
That really, when someone achieves power, it's more likely to show off whatever their sort of moral status was before the achievement of that power.
Right.
Now, we may live in a world where it is easier for people with sort of a corrupt moral sense to achieve and maintain and expand their power.
Right.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that just by having power, you can switch somebody from being altruistic and positive to being a despot. I don't know. I mean, is Star Trek making a definitive statement about that? I don't necessarily think so. Star Trek is a big universe.
Yeah.
And I think that we see a lot of examples, particularly within Starfleet itself, of showing power, certainly technological power, human power, the hierarchies in place of not abusing that, and always trying to live up to the higher ideal that we set for ourselves. So much of what we've seen in the first couple of seasons that we've reviewed, we sat down and tried to come up with what are the big themes so far. And we didn't really get into that in our panel too much the other day, but that is the interesting mission of Mission Log here.
Yeah.
So by the end of the run, whether it's by the end of a season or a series or the entirety of Star Trek, what are the big themes that come out? I don't think that's necessarily one of them. I don't think absolute power corrupting is one of the big takeaways, but I do think one of the big takeaways is that every time we achieve something, we kind of need to reassess, set the bar, and then decide that, as Ken beautifully says, we have to do the hard work to get there.
Yeah.
You know, we can't take the easy way out once we've made that achievement.
I will say, I think you could make a better case for absolute power corrupting absolutely being one of the themes than you can anything to do with genetic engineering.
Sure.
I think one writer was saying that for 1 week. Mm-hmm. And certainly you do again address that, as you say, with Bashir in Deep Space Nine. But there's a lot of wiggle room there. I mean, there's a complete distrust of computers. Computers that do anything besides what you tell them to, there is complete distrust of those in the original series, and then we get Data.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's that's the thing. I mean, it's sort of an evolving, because the times evolve, you know.
Yeah.
It would have been very easy to go back and just remake Star Trek. I mean, they could have done Phase 2 and been done, but they didn't even, going from Phase 2 to Star Trek the Motion Picture, I don't remember how it did at the box office. I don't know, because I was a kid. I know for years it was a derided movie, and so I sort of assumed that it was a movie that needed to be derided, and that's bad, and they really didn't get their feet until Star Trek
right.
II. It's, I mean, and in a lot of ways, it's no Omega Corey, but I mean, there are a lot, there's lots of stuff that's painful about Star Trek the Motion Picture, but they came right in and tackled, like, nutty ideas.
Yeah.
Including the fact that, I mean, we have this evolving computer that's gone out and learned all of this stuff, and we're now having, that's part of the evolution of it, honestly. Kirk
right.
then has to deal with, okay, whether it's because he can't kill it, or because Spock said, don't do the thing, and for once Kirk said,
okay,
I'm well, not going to do the thing.
Not going to do the thing.
I'm not
right,
going to do
right.
this time, I'm not going to do the thing.
Yeah.
I mean, the very first time that they reboot Star Trek, or they continue Star Trek, they acknowledge that this is an evolving thing. Because
yeah.
in the original series, there is nothing Kirk would have wanted to do more than find a way to turn that off.
Right.
And then that's
right.
it. And he wouldn't have rested until he could turn it off.
Yeah.
He would have been like...
I'm going to talk it to death.
Decker. He would have been Decker on
right.
that. He would have thrown the Enterprise into V'ger
yeah.
at some point, you know, in the original series, if that's what it took.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's interesting. You keep talking about the fact that we're going to have to come back to a theme at some point. I think in the original series, that's just going to be a law of averages.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
a lot going on in the original series.
Yeah.
It's hard to sum it all up.
Yeah.
And it is very inconsistent, you know?
Yeah.
But I
think it's
going to
be easier in next gen.
Yeah.
And,
oh, for,
you know,
sure. for sure.
I mean, because there was actually somebody minding the thread at that point.
All right, guys, this has been an amazing conversation. I must run. I am actually needed over for another broadcasting episode.
Right on,
so thank you guys both for joining me, and we will have to talk more about the motion picture at a later date, because I am excited to hear about more about that.
You cool,
count
cool,
on
cool.
That.
All right.